from Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
The Rachel Maddow Show, weeknights at 9 Eastern on MSNBC.
September 11th, 2001, the day of the Al-Qaeda terrorist attacks on our country. That was a Tuesday. Part of what New Yorkers remember about that day was that it was a local election day, that Tuesday in New York City, a beautiful early fall day when planes hit the buildings and the buildings came down and lower Manhattan turned into hell. But afterwards, even before the next Tuesday rolled around, inside a week of the 9/11 attacks happening, something else on a different scale, but also terrible and terrifying, started to happen in a whole bunch of places all over the country. And at first, we did not know if this was a second act for the 9/11 attack. To the offices of NBC News and ABC News and CBS News and the offices of the New York Post, somewhat inexplicably, to the offices of the National Enquirer tabloid in Florida, somebody mailed anthrax. It wasn't just a white powder that they called anthrax in a terrorizing note in order to scare people. It was actual anthrax, potent anthrax. And it was mailed to those news organizations. It was mailed also to the offices of two different United States senators. It was real anthrax. It was potent, and more than 20 people were infected by the anthrax sent through those mailings. 5 people were killed by it. It was a mysterious attack both then and now. But it did start right after the 9/11 attacks, when the country was absolutely reeling. And we didn't know if it was a second act to the attacks from the morning of Tuesday, September 11th. It added this bioweapons terror dimension to our out-of-control fear and terror at the time. It's almost hard to explain that different dynamic, that different dimension of it, now that we're 20 years down the road from it. But if you lived through it, you know it was a real fear. And one of the things the U.S. government did, places like the U.S. Congress, the United States Supreme Court, parts of government that thought that they could be a next target in what appeared to be an ongoing anthrax biowarfare attack. One of the things that happened in certain parts of the government is that they started immediately to stockpile an antibiotic called Cipro, ciprofloxacin. It's a broad-spectrum antibiotic that you can take to fight an infection caused by something like anthrax. Cipro is made by the Bayer Corporation. And in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 and then the anthrax attacks, which went on for a little while after 9/11, demand for Bayer's antibiotic, for this drug Cipro, just skyrocketed for obvious reasons. The U.S. government told Bayer, in fact, that they wanted to have enough Cipro on hand to treat 12 million Americans simultaneously. And Bayer said, okay, sure, but in order to build up that much of a stockpile, in order to make that many Cipro tablets, it's going to take us more than a year and a half. That's just how long it's going to take us to do that. Is that okay? No, that was not okay. The U.S. government was saying, listen, we don't need this drug to save people 20 months from now. We're being attacked by somebody mysteriously mailing potent anthrax to all different kinds of people right now. We need it now. And Bayer basically said, tough. This is our drug. We own the patent on it. That's how long it's going to take us to make 12 million doses. And then something interesting happened. Some other companies came forward and said, hey, we know this is Bayer's drug and they hold the patent on it, so they're the only ones who are allowed to make it. But if we were allowed to make it, we could make that drug ourselves really quickly. They, in fact, came forward and said that they could make generic versions of it that would fill the entire order the U.S. government wanted in 12 weeks. Bayer was saying it would take them 20 months. These companies came forward and said, we could make it generic and have the whole order filled in 12 weeks. Just say the word. We're happy to do it. And Democrats in Washington very quickly said, we should do that. We need more than Bayer can give us. Fine, let's let other companies jump in and make more. Is the patent really more important than that? A Democratic senator named Chuck Schumer from New York City, which had just been walloped in the 9/11 attacks, he led the charge for the Democrats, saying that the government had the legal right to break Bayer's patent in an unusual circumstance like this in order to let other companies make Cipro so we could have enough. So if the anthrax attacks continued and, God forbid, millions of Americans needed to be treated, then this country could get them treated. Even Republicans in Congress conceded that although they were not inclined to do something like that under normal circumstances, these were not normal circumstances. And in this case, if the administration came forward and said, yeah, that's what we want to do, Republicans in Congress said they'd support it too. They'd break the patent if need be. Now, what ultimately happened back in 2001 is that the George W. Bush administration threatened to, but didn't, break the patent for Cipro. That said, they used the threat that they might, that very real bipartisan threat that they might and they could, they used that threat to make Bayer go back to the drawing board and reconsider what exactly they could do to meet the U.S. government's demands for their drug. With that real threat looming over them, Bayer thought about it again and decided that actually, it might not take 20 months. They announced that they could not only dramatically ramp up their own production of Cipro, but they'd be able to drop the price of it by nearly 50%. And so Bayer kept its patent back in 2001, and the U.S. government got its drug supplies. But Bayer at the time knew they almost didn't keep their patent. They knew the U.S. government almost took over their patent. And that real threat to them is what got them off the mark. That was 20 years ago. Now, today, a version of that story is playing out again on a much larger scale. This time, it's not a mysterious bioweapon arriving in the mail on the heels of a world-changing terrorist attack. This time, it's a global pandemic killing millions of people in every country on Earth. And until there is a cure, what we need to stave off the tide of literally tens of millions of deaths are vaccines against COVID-19. Vaccines against COVID-19, which we have. Well, which we have. But the vast majority of the world still does not. And the current system that we've got for trying to get vaccines out to everyone all over the world so far isn't working. It's at least not working quickly enough. Just take one example of India, the apocalypse underway in India right now, that huge nation of over 1.3 billion people. They've only got 2% of their population vaccinated, and you can see what is happening there in terms of mass infection, mass illness, mass death, a completely overwhelmed healthcare system, people dying in the streets, infection out of control. 2% vaccinated. In contrast, we've got more than 40% of our adults fully vaccinated. Over 80% of our seniors, people over age 65, have had at least one dose, which offers significant protection. And that's good for us, right? We're on our way, even though our numbers aren't high enough yet. But they're at 2% in India? That is a problem that is a human catastrophe right now in India. It is also, honestly, a catastrophe for the whole world, including for us. Because, I mean, the CDC said yesterday the new COVID variant that has emerged from India has already been found in five U.S. states. Right now, the way the global vaccine rollout is going, which is excruciatingly slow and to limited places, I mean, some countries aren't even expecting to get vaccines at all until 2024. Which means not only a huge, ongoing, growing global death toll, it means the continued generation of new and more infectious and more dangerous variants of the coronavirus, which ultimately may render our existing vaccines ineffective, which sends us back to jump. The companies that are making vaccines have done amazing work, right? They moved heaven and earth to get those vaccines done and to get them on the market safe and effective. The vaccines approved in the United States already are miracles. They're scientific miracles. And those vaccines have the potential to save the world if the world can get them. Right now, the world is not on track to get them in anywhere near the time frame that they need to get them in order to get the pandemic under control and in order to prevent the emergence of variants that will render moot the vaccination efforts we've already made and that we're still limping along with. The companies that have developed these vaccines have had the benefit of U.S. government support already, right, to fund the development of the vaccines and their testing and to ramp up manufacturing capacity. The government has helped them to the tunes of billions of dollars. These companies have also sold hundreds of millions of doses already, including to the U.S. government, which, in addition, helped pay for the vaccine's development in the first place in many cases. But now, faced with most countries on Earth not having access to vaccines and anywhere near the numbers they need, now today, the Biden administration has made this incredibly dramatic announcement that they support breaking the patents. They support waiving the patents in a limited way for COVID vaccines. Basically, what that means is that they support giving out the recipe for the vaccines. So other companies, other countries all over the world can make their own generic versions of these vaccines that work. So like those companies that came forward and said, yeah, we know Bayer's got the patent, but we could make Cipro generically if you just let us do it. The Biden administration, in this instance, with COVID vaccines, is saying, yeah, let them do it. Let's make generic drugs. And this was undoubtedly a hard call for them. I mean, the Trump administration was adamantly opposed to doing this. They led, like, you know, the global resistance to doing this. Trump-supporting Republicans in Congress have said they're adamantly opposed to doing this, and they've been lobbying the Biden administration against making this change. Pharmaceutical companies, of course, are more against this than anything else they can imagine. Their whole business plan is based on the idea that they get to invent things, but then own a patent on it that lets them have monopolistic control of that drug and all of the revenue it generates for a generation. But as hard as the decision must have been for the Biden administration, it helps, it matters that at the end of the day, honestly, this is something President Biden explicitly promised that he would do if he were elected president. Addie Barkin is a lawyer. He's an activist. He's a dad. He is also dying from ALS. Mr. Barkin uses a computer speech assistant to speak since ALS took his ability to speak in his own voice. Using that computer-assisted technology, he did an interview, a hard one, a hard-charging interview with then-presidential candidate Joe Biden last summer, last July. And in that interview, Mr. Barkin got this explicit promise from candidate Joe Biden.
The World Health Organization is leading an unprecedented global effort to promote international cooperation in the search for COVID-19 treatments and vaccines. But Donald Trump has refused to join that effort, cutting America off from the rest of the world. If the U.S. discovers a vaccine first, will you commit to sharing that technology with other countries? And will you ensure there are no patents to stand in the way of other countries and companies mass-producing those life-saving vaccines?
Absolutely, positively. This is the only humane thing in the world to do. This guy's whole idea of America on its own is meant America alone. We're out there by ourselves. What's he doing? It lacks any human dignity, what we're doing. So the answer is yes, 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 yes. And it's not only a good thing to do, it's overwhelmingly in our interest to do it as well. Overwhelmingly.
Thank you for that commitment.
The answer is yes, 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 absolutely, positively. It is overwhelmingly in our interest to do it. That was his promise as a candidate. Today, as president, the Biden administration made good on that promise. President Biden's U.S. Trade Representative, Katherine Tai, announcing the administration's decision in precise and definitive terms. I sort of never thought I'd see something like this from the U.S. government, but here it is. This is a global health crisis, and the extraordinary circumstances of the COVID-19 pandemic call for extraordinary measures. The administration believes strongly in intellectual property protections, but in service of ending this pandemic, supports the waiver of those protections for COVID-19 vaccines. We will actively participate in negotiations at the World Trade Organization needed to make that happen. The administration's aim is to get as many safe and effective vaccines to as many people as fast as possible. As our vaccine supply for the American people is secured, The administration will continue to ramp up its efforts, working with the private sector and all possible partners to expand vaccine manufacturing and distribution. It will also work to increase the raw materials needed to produce those vaccines. And that last bit there actually is key, the raw materials. It's one thing for the U.S. to say, it's a huge thing for the U.S. to say, we support suspending the patents, waiving the patents here. We support other countries being given the recipe for making their own generic versions of the COVID vaccines. It's a huge thing, but it is another thing altogether for the Biden administration to say they're going to make sure that the raw materials, the ingredients, the specialized equipment, the trained personnel, the expertise, the know-how, all get out to the world as well. So not only do people have permission theoretically to make their own vaccines, but they actually can. I mean, without hugely ramping up the supply of materials and equipment and expertise and raw materials in particular to make the vaccines, generic or not, we can only increase supply by so much. The Biden administration is saying we will lead global negotiations to give companies and countries around the world permission to do this and to give them the ability to do it safely. This is a huge deal. This is a huge decision for the Biden administration. Obviously, it's a 180-degree U-turn from where the last administration stood on this issue, but it is an advance in terms of the United States saying that we will lead the world on this issue. We will take responsibility for getting this done globally. I mean, if this is done right, it means the United States of America will not only lead global negotiations to get this part of it done, but we will lead the world to make sure there is a global response. So this thing doesn't haunt humanity, including us, for the rest of our time on the planet. The only way out from COVID-19 is for the whole world to get ahead of it. And the only country on earth capable of leading the whole world to get ahead of it is us. And that is what the Biden administration is banking on being able to do. And they are banking on us, the American people, believing in that again. So this is a really big deal. It is a decision that potentially could save tens of millions of human lives. It could make the difference as to whether or not we do ever end this pandemic or if this is it. This is a huge deal. We're going to have one of the world's foremost experts on this who's going to be joining us to talk about it a little bit later on. I'm very much looking forward to that conversation. In terms of what else is going on in the news today, also today, a federal judge ruled that the national moratorium on evictions, the ban on kicking people out of where they live, which went into effect because of the pandemic, went into effect last year. Today, a federal judge ruled that the U.S. government does not have the right to impose a freeze on evictions. Justice Department says that they will appeal that judge's ruling. So we expect that will probably mean the existing eviction ban will stay in place at least temporarily while this thing makes its way through the courts. But that's potentially a big deal. For what it's worth, this is a Trump-appointed judge who's trying to throw out the freeze on evictions. It's the Justice Department under President Biden that's now going to file an appeal to try to keep the eviction freeze in place. We're also watching the Justice Department today for any sign that they may appeal the explosive court ruling that we led the show with last night. A federal judge in Washington ruling yesterday afternoon that Trump Attorney General Bill Barr was, quote, disingenuous, and that he and other Trump administration Justice Department officials basically lied to the court and lied to the public about then Attorney General Bill Barr's decision to not bring federal criminal charges against President Trump after the Mueller report laid out more than 10 instances of potential criminal obstruction of justice by the then president. Judge Amy Berman Jackson yesterday ordered the Justice Department to release to the public a document that the Trump Justice Department has been trying to keep secret for years. It's a document about their decision not to bring criminal charges against Trump. The judge says that she has seen that document, although the Justice Department tried to stop even her from seeing it. She says she has now seen it. She has reviewed it. She says the Trump Justice Department lied about what's in that document. She now wants it released to the public. The Biden Justice Department under Attorney General Merrick Garland now has to decide if they're going to appeal that ruling from the judge or if they will comply with it and go ahead and release that document. The release of that document and the attending drama about why they lied about it, why they tried to keep that document secret for years, that will obviously put a very hot spotlight back on the question of why Trump, in fact, wasn't charged with obstruction of justice, despite all of the evidence of obstruction of justice that was laid out in Mueller's investigation. Before you look it up, I'll just tell you, no, the statute of limitations isn't up. For what it's worth, the statute of limitations on Trump's conduct that was described in that part of the Mueller report, it's generally a 5-year statute of limitations. That stuff was in 2017, 2018, 2019. So there's still time, just saying, in case the Justice Department decided that that question of whether or not he should be charged is one that is still open. After Facebook today issued its weird pseudo-legal-ish decision in which they announced they were upholding the ban on Trump from that social media platform, former President Trump immediately started sending out statements that were apparently designed to remind everyone why he was kicked off that platform in the first place. Literally, right after they said that he was still kicked off Facebook, he put out public statements reiterating his fantasies that he's secretly still president, calling himself president as if he's president now, saying that the last U.S. election shouldn't count because of this fantasy he has, that there was some mysterious fraud that no one can quite describe, which is the only reason Biden appeared to win, but really Trump won. Really, Trump is the one who won it. He puts out that statement. It's like, oh, yeah, now I remember why you were kicked off all the social media platforms. You told all your followers that you were still secretly president and they needed to avenge the fraud that you were fantasizing about. And that led to them violently attacking the U.S. Capitol to try to stop the certification of the election results. Oh, yeah. Thank you for the reminder. That's why you're banned. They just re-upped your ban today. Now I remember why they banned you in the first place. Former President Trump's statement on his election fantasies today appeared to be focused on Arizona, which he has made multiple statements about over the last couple of weeks. Arizona is where Republicans are continuing with this cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs audit of the presidential election results in Arizona, which is being run by a QAnon promoter who has never had any previous experience with administering elections, let alone auditing one. The news from that thing today was amazing. The auditors admitted today that after a couple of weeks of hammering away at the 2.1 million ballots they're reviewing, they're through much less than 10% of the ballots. That led much of the Arizona press corps to do the math on this thing to come to the quick conclusion that apparently they're going to try to drag on this audit slash recount well into the summer. Around the time everybody was arriving at that conclusion that this thing is going to have to go for weeks and weeks and weeks if they stay at this pace, the venue where they're doing it, the arena where they're holding the supposed recount, announced publicly that actually they're not welcome to stay. They've got other things booked for that space, and so they're not going to be allowed to stay past the middle of May. So they're doing this thing at a pace that will require them to be there all summer. They're not going to have any place to do it as of a week and a half from now. So that's a complication. The local ABC station in Phoenix also reporting today that the so-called official observers of the audit are required to sign non-disclosure agreements, which, of course, a non-disclosure agreement prohibits you from telling anybody something that you've seen or experienced. So they're observers, but they are not allowed to tell anyone what they have observed. Also seems like a little bit of a complication. Also, one of the guys running the audit explained today on camera that what they're doing with the ballots, why it's taking so long, why they've been through less than 10% of them already, is because they're taking a very, very careful look at the ballots. What are they looking for? They're looking for bamboo. Because it's possible that maybe China came over and made Joe Biden president by something Asia bamboo ballots something.
The other day at the press conference, you were talking about bamboo. What was that about?
Well, is that there's accusations that 40,000 ballots were flown in.
Into Arizona,
and it was stuffed into the box, okay? And it came from the southeast part of the world, Asia, okay? And what they're doing is to find out if there's bamboo in the paper. That camera right there, that they take a picture of the ballot.
They came over from the southeast part of the world, and they put it in the box. There you go. Trump's president. They're looking for bamboo in the ballots. Because Trump is secretly president because China, or maybe just Asia, made bamboo ballots and flew them to Arizona, and they can find them with the camera. So they have to use the camera on all of the ballots. The Republican Party is on the verge of kicking out some of their House leadership because of insufficient loyalty to Donald Trump. Donald Trump is now the animating focus of the Republican Party right now because of their absolute outrage that he's not being allowed back onto social media to keep promoting the idea that he secretly won the election. He wants to promote the fact that Arizona's recount is going to prove that he secretly won the election. What are they doing in Arizona? They're looking for the bamboo. Because bamboo, Asia, planes, that must look at the camera. I mean, one of these parties is not like the other, but this is how we're proceeding boldly into the future right now. Lots to get to tonight. Stay with us.
The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in three key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations. And they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR by visiting unrefugees.org/donation.
Today, the Biden administration announced it would back a proposal to let other countries manufacture generic versions of the COVID-19 vaccines that have been developed by big pharmaceutical companies and that offer the world's best hope at beating back this pandemic and saving tens of millions of lives. And it sounds like a technical change. It sounds like kind of a business pages thing. But to people who follow this kind of thing, to people in the public health world, this is a huge deal. You've probably heard of the group Doctors Without Borders, the international aid group. They're sometimes known by their acronym in French, MSF. Here's how MSF, Doctors Without Borders, reacted today when this news was announced. They said, quote, "This is huge. The United States of America is putting lives over profits." They then go on to list a number of other countries and groups that have yet to endorse this proposal, including Canada, the UK, Brazil, the EU, asking when they will follow the example set by the United States and, quote, get on the right side of history. Other big expert groups in this field who push for this change are calling on the Biden administration now that they've made this call to stand their ground, to make sure that this gets followed through, and to be ready as industry tries to push back and delay or reverse this decision. The U.S.-based AIDS and human rights activist group, HealthGap, said in a statement today, quote, "This is a necessary first step from the Biden administration, but negotiations must not drag on indefinitely. Already 2.2 million people have died of COVID-19 since this waiver was first proposed back in October. The Biden administration must not cave to big pharma scare tactics and its army of lobbyists that will undoubtedly kick into high gear to stall further progress." Another big, hugely influential nonprofit, Partners in Health, which delivers healthcare in some of the world's poorest countries, one of the most inspirational nonprofits operating anywhere on the face of the earth. Partners in Health had a similar message, essentially applauding it, but saying, now stick to it and let's get it done. Partners in Health says, quote, "We applaud the decision of the United States to support the waiver of intellectual property protections on COVID vaccines to help end the pandemic. We call on the United States to follow through on this commitment, make sure that we don't delay negotiations on the waiver." People who follow this stuff, people who have made a life out of trying to work on global health issues, global public health issues, see this as a huge deal, and the amount of urgency they feel to follow through on it and make sure it happens tells you how big a deal they think this is. Joining us now is Dr. Joya Mukherjee. She is the chief medical officer for Partners in Health. She's also an associate professor at Harvard Medical School. Professor Mukherjee, thank you so much for joining us. It's a real pleasure to have you here.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on, Rachel.
So I'm not an expert on this stuff. I used to work in a previous life on things sort of indirectly adjacent to this, but it's been a long time, and I know this is a complicated decision. Let me just ask you to correct me if there's any part of this that I've explained wrong so far.
Yeah, no, not at all, Rachel. And I was thinking that I know you have a background in AIDS activism. I'm wearing my AIDS pin today, wrong side, you know, to remind us that these are lessons that we have all learned together across the globe in fighting for treatment access and fighting for the globe to share the fruits of modernity and share the fruits of science. And that is really a basic human right.
In terms of the practicalities here, some of the people who argued against doing this and people who have suggested that it's the right thing to do, but it's not enough, have said that the bottleneck here isn't necessarily the patent. It's not necessarily the recipe, that, you know, the intellectual property. It's that the capacity to manufacture vaccines is really hard to develop. You need the ingredients. You need the equipment. You need the know-how for how to do it. You need trained personnel to help you learn how to do it and then to get you started. How much of that can the United States do or lead on in order to help the promise of this decision be made manifest?
Yeah, that is such a great question. We at Partners in Health and our allies at HealthGap and 100 countries that have been urging the Biden administration and other wealthy countries to support the TRIPS waiver never said that the TRIPS waiver was enough. There are really three key aspects that we want to see here. One is the waiver, because it's not just one patent. Each individual step may be patented. Several of the processes may be patented. So that's one thing. The second is really sharing the know-how. How do you make this? This is a relatively new kind of vaccine, the mRNA vaccine, although many labs and facilities have been working with mRNA for decades. So sharing the know-how is the second important thing. And then the third is really the funding. And we saw that even in the George W. Bush administration, the U.S. was a leader in global AIDS by putting in the funding for this to happen. Interestingly, there's already $16 billion committed to global work on the COVID-19 vaccine. So the money is there. We hope the U.S. will continue to put money into this effort. We need to have the know-how shared, the raw materials, and the patents. The patents are one step, but they are a major step. They're a gateway to a cascade of things that have to happen. And many of us were very stunned today and very thrilled to see the message from Ambassador Tai saying that the Biden administration would support the waiver. But we know that that's only one step. And right now, what we're focused on is really having very transparent text-based negotiations that we are all able to see that won't overrepresent the needs of the big pharmaceutical companies or CEOs and really will work to end the pandemic.
Dr. Joya Mukherjee, Chief Medical Officer for Partners in Health, thank you so much for your time tonight. As you said, and I think a lot of people in this space were thrilled with this announcement today. But in order to make this manifest, it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of alacrity. The government's going to have to go fast here. I know that people like you and your organization and a lot of other advocates in this space will be pushing them hard to do so. Thank you so much for helping us understand.
You're welcome. And thanks so much for having us on.
All right. Much more ahead tonight. Stay with us.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood,
which means affordable, high-quality, basic healthcare for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the healthcare we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves healthcare. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
See if you can spot the difference between these two stories. Here's story number one. 2016, a woman in Tarrant County, Texas, named Crystal Mason, went to her local polling place to vote, but she discovered her name wasn't on the voting rolls there. At the suggestion of a poll worker, Ms. Mason filled out a provisional ballot. She was told, basically, you know, we're not sure what the problem is, but fill out a provisional ballot instead of a normal one. That way, if there is any real problem here, we won't count it. A few months later, Crystal Mason was arrested and charged with illegal voting. Because when she filled out that provisional ballot, she was on supervised release after completing a prison sentence for a federal conviction. She thought because she had served her time in prison, she was then eligible to vote. She didn't know that under Texas law, you're not eligible to vote until you have also completed any probation or supervised release after release from prison. Even though it was a technical and sort of complex misunderstanding, and even though her provisional ballot was never counted, she was nonetheless convicted and sentenced to 5 years in prison for illegal voting. 5 years in prison. That's story number one. Here's story number two. A guy in Delaware County, Pennsylvania, a man named Bruce Bartman, filled out a voter registration application for his mother last year, even though his mother had been dead for a dozen years. Mr. Bartman then requested and submitted an absentee ballot in her name with a vote for Donald Trump for president in 2020. The state of Pennsylvania flagged his mom's voter registration as belonging to a dead person, but he signed and sent back a letter swearing that she was actually still alive. He did all of that in order to deliberately cast a fraudulent vote for Donald Trump. He pled guilty to it in court. He was just sentenced. He got 5 years probation. So, can you spot the difference? Crystal Mason in Texas tries to vote because she doesn't know that she's not technically eligible. Her vote is never counted, 5 years in prison. Bruce Bartman in Pennsylvania, elaborate premeditated scheme to cast a dead person's vote for Donald Trump, including swearing that the person wasn't dead after he started to get caught, all is forgiven, 5 years probation. I know there has to be something that explains the radical difference in prosecution and punishment of these two people. I just can't quite put my finger on it. Meanwhile, two other Republican gentlemen in Pennsylvania are also currently facing voter fraud charges. One guy who, just like Bruce Bartman, registered his dead mom to vote. Another guy who went and cast his ballot at his local polling place and then came back 45 minutes later wearing sunglasses to cast a ballot in his son's name. Somehow an alert poll worker saw through his brilliant sunglasses disguise. Voter fraud is very rare. There are a few instances of it here and there. They're usually ridiculous. After the November election, when Republicans were having trouble finding any actual examples of the giant epidemic of Democratic voter fraud they were fantasizing about, they were sure had just taken place, the Republican Lieutenant Governor of Texas, Dan Patrick, publicly offered a $1 million reward for anybody providing evidence of voter fraud in the 2020 election. For months now, his counterpart in the great state of Pennsylvania, Democratic Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman of Pennsylvania, has been needling Dan Patrick about this. When are you going to cough up that $1 million? I got three cases of voter fraud right here in Pennsylvania. Three Trump supporters, Dan. Where's my money? One was a guy casting a ballot for Trump in his dead mother's name. Not the kind of evidence you had in mind. I got a second one of those, too, if you want to try that. But despite the Texas lieutenant governor's apparent inability to find any evidence of any kind of voter fraud that he says is rampant, not even for $1 million, Republicans in Texas are nevertheless pushing ahead with this idea that some fantasy about rampant voter fraud justifies draconian new restrictions on voting in Texas. The attempted voting rights rollback is so severe that dozens of big Texas companies, not known for taking strong political stands, have now come out and spoken out against it. But the leaders of Texas's biggest city and county took a forceful step today to try to get the business community to do more and to try to rally the community against what Texas Republicans are trying to do to Texas voting. One of those leaders joins us live here next. Stay with us. In 2020, Harris County, Texas broke its all-time voter turnout record, and it did so almost a full week before Election Day. More people voted early in Harris County, Texas last year than voted in all of 2016. They set that record in large part because the county made a huge push to expand voting access to the county's citizens. They hired a ton of new poll workers. They made it easier to vote by mail. They did a bunch of innovative stuff like offering 24-hour polling places. They offered drive-through voting, which is a nice thing during a pandemic. Over 127,000 people, about 8% of all Harris County voters, cast their ballots using the drive-through option. And all those different things paid off together big time. More people voted in Harris County than ever before. Well, now Republicans who control the Texas state legislature have made it their mission to make sure that does not happen again. They've got two bills specifically targeting big populous counties like Harris County with the aim of stopping the kinds of innovative things the county put in place to make it easier to vote last year. Which is in part why yesterday, 175 business leaders from the Houston area sent a letter to the Republican-led legislature saying why they oppose those bills. But as you can see from the Houston Chronicle headline there, one key group was missing, the Greater Houston Partnership, which is the region's largest chamber of commerce.
There's a group sticking out like a sore thumb for failing to speak up at a time of enormous consequence. Right now, voting rights are falling like dominoes in states across the country, from Georgia to Arizona, to right here in Texas, and yet the largest chamber of commerce in the Houston area is silent.
That is the top elected official in Harris County, Texas, Judge Lena Hidalgo, today singling out the largest chamber of commerce in the Houston area for their silence on Texas Republicans attacking voting rights, even when so many other Texas business leaders are standing up and saying they will not abide it. Joining us now is Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo, who is essentially the chief executive of Harris County, the most populous county in Texas. Judge Hidalgo, it's nice to see you. Thanks for making time.
Thank you.
How important is business support for voting rights going to be in the end as Republicans in the legislature really take aim at voting rights statewide and seem to be taking aim specifically at places like your county?
Look, it's very important for all of us to stand up against this, but the business community is uniquely positioned to make a difference. This is not a transient, quote unquote, political partisan issue. This is about, are you willing to stand up for and fight for American democracy? Do you believe in American democracy? I think of Martin Luther King writing from Birmingham jail. I think about the blood that has been spilled to protect that promise of America, to protect that light that we fight for around the world. And when some folks are trying to turn democracy itself into a wedge issue, we need to stand up and make clear voting rights, democracy is something we thought we'd already won and been done with. The business community, more than anybody else, can stand up and prevent this from becoming a wedge issue.
Judge Hidalgo, one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you tonight is watching that press conference. You made the point that this Chamber of Commerce, the Greater Houston Partnership, they wouldn't even let their members take a vote internally about whether or not they wanted to publicly oppose these bills. I wanted to ask you why you raised that point and what you think that means.
Yeah, it's almost hard to believe. But essentially, I've heard from respected business leaders of major businesses in the Houston area, leaders in this Chamber of Commerce, that they requested that the leadership meet and that they hold a vote to decide whether or not
the chamber itself is going to come out in opposition to these voting bills. And the response was that no vote will be held. I was just on the phone with some of the chamber leaders. They're telling me they have a meeting tomorrow. It's a discussion meeting, but they're not going to be allowed to vote on possibly taking a stance. So it's voter suppression on the topic of voter suppression. And it does make you wonder if you have to suppress the vote lest the membership come out against voter suppression, what are you doing here? You have to remember too, Rachel, these bills single out Harris County. You pointed out our innovations that are about bringing voting into the 21st century that Republicans as well as Democrats used in record numbers. They're attacking my constituents, my community, the community that this chamber and these businesses are meant to represent. And so that's why it's just so ironic, and we need everybody to continue taking a stand.
Harris County, Texas Judge Lena Hidalgo, essentially the executive of the county there. Thank you so much for your time tonight. We're watching this closely as we're watching other states that are trying to beat back these voting rights restrictions around the country. But in Texas, it seems like things are getting quite intense. Thanks for helping us understand tonight, Judge.
Thank you.
I'll be right back. Stay with us. Before we go tonight, a little bit of breaking news on a story that we covered at the top of the show. This has just developed since we've been on the air. The U.S. Justice Department tonight, the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, has just sent this letter to the Republican-controlled Arizona State Senate, essentially warning them that their so-called audit of the 2020 presidential election, this recount they're doing of the presidential election result in Arizona, which is being conducted by a company with no elections experience run by a QAnon promoter, the Justice Department is now warning that may be in violation of federal law, in part because they have turned over these actual ballots from a federal election to a private company when ballots are legally required to be under the control of elections officials. Also, interestingly, because the people doing this audit say they may go door to door asking people about their votes, and that would constitute voter intimidation under federal law. Again, this record just sent tonight, we don't know what this portends, but if the U.S. Justice Department is getting involved in this bananas recount in Arizona, that could potentially be a very, very big deal. Watch this space. That's going to do it for us for now. See you again tomorrow night.
The Rachel Maddow Show, weeknights at 9 Eastern on MSNBC.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.